speakers. I heard him in 1981, I think it was, up in Portland, Oregon. He and his wife came up and spoke at our state conference, and I was just getting into the program, you know. I'd been around it for a long time, but I was really getting on it, and his inspirational wisdom helped me a lot. And this guy moves around. At that time, he was living in Riverside, and he had a group he started at Attitude Adjustment, and I was over in Riverside on business, and I looked all over town for Dr. Paul in this meeting, and I finally found it, but he'd moved. And the last I'd heard, he was up in Bellevue, and now he's back in Laguna Niguel. So I would like to welcome, in a big round, for Dr. Paul.
Good evening. My name is Paul, and I'm a full-blown alcoholic. And that's pretty good for me, considering the fact I wasn't even an alcoholic when I came here. I want to, geez, they got a lot of drunks in Signal Hill, don't they? want to welcome all the, all new people. Both those that stood up and those that didn't stand up. And I want to congratulate the CHIP people and the birthday people. And glad you're here, glad you're staying sober. As I said, I wasn't even an alcoholic when I came here. I don't know how it is. And this business of being a visitor, he said he was upset when he didn't ask for visitors. I always wanted to stand up as a visitor. I didn't intend to stay here, for God's sake. I was only here by mistake anyhow, through a misunderstanding, series of misunderstandings. As a matter of fact, coming to AA meetings was the only way I could get a pass to get off the nut ward. As accident, through a series of mistakes and misunderstandings and confusion, I was ended up on the nut ward of the hospital I was on the staff of. And I didn't belong there. And they had a real strange philosophy there. I never have understood it. They had the philosophy that they somehow tried to convince me that the quality of my life would be improved if I learned how to make leather belts. And I never could see how my life could be improved in any way if I learned how to make leather belts. And didn't understand the philosophy, and didn't understand the instructions. And for some strange reason, I come to kind of some of these AA meetings, and I went back to the hospital, and I made the most beautiful pair of moccasins you've ever seen. I don't know what the connection is, because I've never seen any occupational therapy booth in an AA meeting. And if you're new here tonight, you might stick around long enough to make a pair of moccasins. I love my moccasins. I used to wear them all the time. Well, not all the time, but I wore them all the time I could. And when they'd wear out, I'd repair them. When the tongs would break, I'd patch them up. But those things wore good. They took 7 years before those moccasins wore out to the point where I couldn't repair them anymore. And I felt bad. Not bad enough to go back and make another pair, but apparently my wife might have thought I was thinking of going back and make another pair. And my dear Al-Anon wife, for my 7th AA birthday, she had my moccasins bronze. And it was all screaming and yelling, and I thought, my God, man, why don't you lower your voice? These people all think I'm a nut. Why don't we leave it at that? You know? All I know is that he finally ended up saying, well, that's my story. I'm going to a meeting tonight. Would you like to go along? And I said, hell no, I won't like it. But I'd go because I knew, I just figured if I didn't go, he'd go back and squeal to that dumb psychiatrist. And he would have, too. And so he went to the meeting. But I always wanted, then I found out that the psychiatrist really liked to talk to me then. He used to be ignore me. He'd go talk to the other patient, and he'd ignore me. So now that I was going to, I went to this AA meeting, he wanted to know everything that went on. So I wanted to go to all the meetings I could. In fact, I told Frank, I said, I want to go every day now. And he was good about that. Frank was pretty good about taking me, except he wasn't so sure about Friday night. He thought Friday night he might have a date with Carolyn. And I thought, well, that's a hell of a way to run an organization. And I reported him to the psychiatrist. Psychiatrist suggested maybe I ought to mind my own affairs, and he got a different attorney named Nelson to take me on Friday nights. And he went to the meetings. I went to all the meetings I could. So I had to figure that I got so many brownie points for each meeting I went to. If I got enough brownie points, they'd let me out of that goofy place. And as a matter of fact, that's what they did. But when I went, I wanted to be listed as a visitor. I didn't intend to stay. Why would I stay in AA, for God's sake? I wasn't an alcoholic. This gets better. I mean, you really don't have to leave now. Let's see. If he doesn't like that story, maybe I better try a different one. Well, screw him. It's the only story I got. And I've considered going out and getting another story, and I thought, hell no, the price is too high. You know. I'm stuck with the same story. I have to listen to it more often than you do. So, as I said, I wasn't even an alcoholic. I came to these meetings. I drank. Of course, I drank. Everybody drinks. We live in a drinking society. You have to drink if you live here. I mean, nobody would ever invite you any place if you didn't drink. Just everybody drinks. You can't not drink. In fact, if you don't drink, people think, my God, you must be an alcoholic. You must have a problem or something like that. So you have to drink. So I drank, of course. And I wouldn't say that I got drunk. I hated that word. I came to AA and they talk about it all the time, talking about drunks and getting drunk. In fact, they're rather fanatics about it. They have one lousy beer and they say, you're drunk, you've been drinking. And a beer doesn't count. I mean, I drank beer and light wine when I quit. you don't pay attention to that. But I would get sick. It wouldn't be because I got drunk, or it wouldn't be because I accidentally got drunk. It would be like I drunk on an empty stomach. That'll do it. Drink on an empty stomach. You never should do that because you might get high when you don't mean to. Or mix your drinks. Mix your drinks. That'll do it too. I used to mix my drinks and thank you. We're glad you're back. Anybody else want anything back at the bar, tell him so he can just deliver it all at one time. That way there won't be as much confusion and traffic walking back and forth. Or anybody else have a compulsive need to be noticed, this is a good time to stand up, you know, and we'll all give you a hand or something. What'd you say his name is, Paul? What's your name? Carlin.
Colin.
Colin. You an alcoholic?
Yeah, I am.
Anyone want to say hello to Colin, the alcoholic?
Hi, Colin. Yeah.
No, damn it, sit still the rest of the meeting. Or another thing I would do, I'd get accidentally drunk because I got some bad booze. There's lots of bad booze out there. They have to watch that. And but I certainly wasn't one of the alcoholics. Alcoholics know what they're doing and they do it anyway. They know they're ruining their life. They know they're ruining their family's life. They know they're doing things against society, but they know that and they do it anyway. That's what an alcoholic is, I thought. And I wasn't that. Alcoholics don't care what they're doing, and I cared, so I couldn't be an alcoholic. But I did, as I say, I got accidentally drunk a lot of times when I drank. But I didn't get drunk every time I drank. But the longer I drank, the harder it was for me to tell whether or not I had passed out or blacked out or simply gone to sleep. I did my drinking at night, and I'd find myself in the morning, usually in bed, usually in my own. But I know that funny things happened more. The longer I drank, the more often odd things happened. And I came to these meetings. I kept coming because it made my psychiatrist happy. And my wife enjoyed the meetings, and she liked coming. But then when she would act up, I would punish her and decide not to come to the meetings. And then that stupid woman went off and did something she can't even do. We lived in Anaheim, and she got in the car and drove down the freeway, which she can't do. We went to the meetings that we went to in Laguna Beach, even though she's not an alcoholic. And we went to Laguna Beach so I wouldn't run into anybody I knew. And of course, now 20 years later, I've gone to Laguna Beach long enough, I've run into everybody that goes to Laguna Beach, so they won't run into anybody they know. And she would drive all the way down to Laguna Beach on the freeway and go to the meeting by herself. Now, I don't know if you've ever sat home on a Saturday night and drank all by yourself while your non-alcoholic wife was off laughing it up in an AA meeting. But it gets kind of boring, so I started back to the meetings, and I kept going to the meetings. And I went to the meetings just a little bit too long. I went there just long enough that I finally caught the disease. It's a contagious disease, and you get it in meetings like this. And if you're here tonight and you're not really an alcoholic, I advise you to be very careful. It's a contagious disease, and you get it in meetings like this. And as a matter of fact, that's why they always have a show of hands. You say, all the alcoholics, please raise their hand. And you see a lot of them raise their hands. There's always a quorum at an AA meeting. And then they have this, when they introduce themselves, they always say, my name is Paul, and I'm an alcoholic. The reason they do that is so you can't say you weren't warned that you were near somebody that was sick. You get the disease. It's a contagious disease, and you pick it up in meetings like this. People think you get alcoholism out there in the bars. You don't get alcoholism out there in the bars. There aren't any alcoholics out there. You try it sometime. Try it sometime. Walk in the nearest bar down here. Walk in and say, I'm running a survey. Will all the alcoholics please raise their hand? You won't get the same response there. You won't get the same response. In fact, they won't even think you're very damn funny, you know? Alcoholics are all in meetings. They don't have time to go to the bar. They're always in the meetings instead. And, I used to drink, and I got accidentally drunk, and until I finally, and I came to these meetings just long enough, I became an alcoholic. Now I'm an alcoholic. Funny thing is, I don't even drink. And I haven't been drunk since the last time I took a drink. You know, so. But anyway, the funny part of that was when I became an alcoholic, I thought, if I'm an alcoholic, that means I react peculiarly to this drug. I do weird and peculiar things when I drink it. For one thing, when I drink it, each drink feels like one more drink. And if I can't resist the first drink, I'm certainly not going to be able to resist the second one. Or the third one, because each drink makes it feel more like one more drink was just going to do it. A lot of people say when they drank, they felt wonderful. Just felt wonderful. And I didn't feel all that wonderful when I drank. I felt like I was... Well, I felt like this drink isn't going to do it, but the next one really is. You know? Or like Father Terry says, he didn't feel wonderful more, that sort of thing. And I couldn't, and every time I had quit drinking before I became an alcoholic, I had quit a lot of times, but every time I'd quit, every single time I had quit drinking, sooner or later, usually sooner, I ended up drunk. And I thought, geez, this quitting drinking is hard on my health. And I thought, if I'm an alcoholic, I can't drink, but if I quit, I'll end up drunk again. And so I couldn't drink and I couldn't quit. And then I remembered this dumb stuff you say, we just don't drink today, or we don't take one drink for one day, or we don't quit drinking, we just don't take the first drink. One drink's too many and a thousand's not enough, and all that simplistic stuff, the kind of stuff you tell. Well, you tell that to the alcoholics. You don't tell that to doctors, for God's sake. It's too stupid, too simple. But I thought one day, I think I'll try that and see what happens. And I didn't drink all that day, and nothing happened. And I thought, I'll try that another day. Nothing happened that day. And I tried it another day, and nothing happened that day. And pretty much that's the way I do it. I drank many yesterday. And I'm certainly going to drink tomorrow, but I don't drink today. And I have every intention of drinking tomorrow. In fact, I don't know that I'd be able to keep from drinking today if I didn't know for certain I was going to drink tomorrow. I just put it off till tomorrow. And when tomorrow gets here, I check the time, and if it's today, I won't drink today. Which is pretty much the way I've always lived. I always thought I wasn't happy yesterday, and I'm not happy today, but I'm going to be happy tomorrow. And you're going to be happy tomorrow when this happens or that happens, or this straightens out, or my wife straightens out, or my kids behave, or I get something more, or I have more money, or whatever. Whenever, then I'll be happy then. I wasn't happy yesterday, I'm not happy today. Don't want to be happy today, I don't want to waste anything. I'm going to have it happy tomorrow. And but when tomorrow came, I didn't recognize it because I thought it was today. And so today I just live in today and not in tomorrow, and enjoy today. And I tell you, I'm willing to take the risk of being happy today, and willing to put up with whatever it takes to not drink today. And so I become an alcoholic, and but when I became an alcoholic after I've been coming to these meetings for 7 months, I accepted my alcoholism. I accepted it. Okay, God, I think I really got screwed. I have this disease, and I never even asked for it. Nobody even asked me if I wanted to be an alcoholic. I had no choice in the matter. I don't know that I did anything to make me an alcoholic, but somehow I got the disease. Now, what are we going to do about it? Okay, I'm an alcoholic, but now let's get on with living. There must be more to life than just the fact that I can't drink. And I think at that point, I accepted the challenge of being an alcoholic, the challenge of being comfortable out there in spite of the fact that I can't drink like other people. And I think what I did is I switched from living in the answer, switched from living in the problem to living in the answer, because the problem was I used to try to drink without being an alcoholic. I used to try to drink without getting accidentally drunk. But once I became an alcoholic, I don't drink, so that's not a problem. I won both battles just by accepting the fact that indeed I am an alcoholic. I can't drink because I don't react normally to that drug. And I just don't drink today. And it's worked very well for me. I've accepted the challenge of living life successfully sober. And it's amazing how my life has changed since that moment. It's amazing how my life has changed since the moment I accepted the challenge of living life without alcohol and other mind and mood affecting drugs and chemicals. And the reason is, I'm sure, that in order to live drug and chemical free, I've had to do a lot of things which I wouldn't have done otherwise. And as a result of doing the other things, my life is just entirely different than it's ever been. It's entirely different. I've had to work the steps. I had to write a four-step inventory. I've done it four times. Four complete inventories. Four complete fourths and fifth steps. Fourth step is where you write the inventory. Fifth is where you read it to another person. I've done a complete inventory four times, and I've done innumerable spot inventories on a point, on a problem, on an area, on a difficulty. And so I had a lot of spot inventories in four majors. I've done all the steps through repeatedly. I live by the steps. It's a way of life for me. I have a sponsor. I call him every day. I have people I sponsor, and I have them call me every day. I don't call my sponsor every day. I said that, didn't I? I used to. I call him frequently, and he calls me. And so we call back and forth. And I have a number of people that call me every day. And and our social life revolves around it. And I go to a lot of meetings, and when I don't find the kind of meeting I want, I decide what it is I want, and I go start a meeting. In fact, if you ever find yourself bitching about the meetings, you know, they don't have what you want, for God's sake, go start what you want, you know. All it takes is a book and a coffee pot and a meeting place. If it's a good idea, the meeting will continue. If it isn't a good idea, it'll die out. Who cares, you know? Either way, you've stayed sober just starting the meeting. I bet I've started a dozen, 15 meetings. It's a lot of fun. It's a way to get to be secretary of a meeting. You know? When they vote you out, then you go start another one, by God. You know? To hell with them. after you've been sober a while, they don't vote you in as secretary anymore. So then you have to do other things. In fact, I went back to the meeting that I was one of my home groups. I used to have a home group for every day of the week. And I went back, when we moved away, moved around, moved up Seattle, moved back here, moved to Laguna Niguel, started going back to the Wednesday night Laguna Beach meeting, and it changed. They changed my home group. It was different than it was when I left it. They screwed it up. And I talked and talked and talked about it. I got real upset. Couldn't stand the meeting. I was deciding I'd stop going to the dumb meeting and find some other place to go on Wednesday night. And I thought, well, just before I leave, I think what I'll do is somebody says that boredom, because I was getting bored at the meeting. Somebody said boredom is lack of involvement. So I thought, okay, I'll show them. I'll get involved. And you got a new secretary and ask for new people to do things. And now I want you to know I'm in charge of kitchen cleanup. And we don't ask for volunteers. We just go around and collar people and drag them in the kitchen. And that's the cleanest meeting you ever saw anymore. You'd be surprised how that meeting has shaped up since there's a clean kitchen. It's getting involved. And it's getting involved with other people, working with other people. Working with other people is fun as long as you're working with people that want the program and want everything they can get out of it. People you work with are either winners in the sense they want everything they can get out of it, or they're whiners. They want to whine about their problems, or they want to say what the problem is so they can move into doing something about it. I got a couple of guys that whiners. Whine, 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 whine. Didn't want to do anything about it except to whine, 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 whine. All they want to do is whine, whine, whine. And I spent all my time on the phone listening to these guys. Whine, 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 whine. And I was getting right there, but they weren't doing anything I was telling them. All they were doing was whine, 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 whine. You know what I did with them? I gave them each the other guy's phone number. You know what they did? First thing they did, each one identified the other guy's problem. You know, that took care of that. But today I found that I'm willing to go to any length to stay physically sober, any length at all. There's nothing I'm not willing to do to stay physically sober. Now that I've been sober a while, now I don't have any problems with not drinking. I distinguish between the thought of a drink, we're talking about drinking, so I'm thinking about drinking, or a desire for a drink, or a compulsion to drink. Anytime I have either a desire for a drink or a compulsion to drink, all I have to do is think it through. In fact, a long time back, a waitress walked by with a tray of martinis. Martinis, you know, in a stem glass and the sweat running down the side of the glass and everything, and an olive on a toothpick. And I thought, well, doesn't that look good? Like gin. And so all I have to do is think it through. I might want to drink, but I don't want to drink. So I really don't want to drink. And the same way with a pill. I took a lot of pills, but I never became a pill head or I never abused the pills. That's what doctors always say. You ask the doctor how a patient got hooked on their pills, they'll always tell you. That's always the same. The patient abused the pills. I don't know what they do. I guess they throw them on the floor and stomp them. Beat them up. Give them verbal abuse. Why, you goddamn little pill. I doubt if they give them any sexual abuse, but I don't know what it is. I don't know. I don't know how you abuse pills. I never abused any pills. I treated my pills with very great respect. Even had this little pocket. That's what that little pocket is for, is to keep pills in it. And I never ever took them. I never ever took a pill unless I had the symptom that only that pill would relieve. You know? I either had it or I could feel it coming on. I was in the hospital. That first step admitted we were alcoholic and our lives had become unmanageable. Well, I certainly wasn't an alcoholic, but I did have to admit that there was a certain element of unmanageability in my life, in the fact that I found myself in the nut ward of the hospital. when the psychiatrist was telling, people were telling me when to get up and when to go to bed and how to make the bed and what pills to take. In fact, they come in the morning and wake you up. It took you all night to get to sleep. By the time you got to sleep, they'd wake you up. They give you a handful of pills, including some Thorazine. And Thorazine, among other things, it makes sunlight very hard to look at the sun. And you give you the Thorazine, and then they say, come on out, and we're going to play volleyball. And the boys are going to play the girls. Oh, crap. You know, why do you have to play the girls, for God's sake? You get out there in the sunlight, you go, oh, I can't even see, you know. And one of the girls gets on the other side of the court, and she says, here it comes, and boom, she hits the ball. Here it comes. Oh, better get going, feet. Oh, yeah. And the goddamn court has the very borders of the court is a concrete block wall. Yeah, that's a criminal thing. There's blood all over that wall. I mean, well, everybody with Thorazine goes right into it, you know. I think the nurses stood in there watching. There he goes. Yeah. Watching it. Boy, he hit it that time, you know. Yeah. Yeah, give him a little more Thorazine tomorrow, you know. God, I used to hate that. And the second step came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. I believed in God, I always had, except I couldn't stand him, and he hated me, so that we didn't talk to each other anymore. We hated each other's guts. Hadn't done that for about 3-4 years before ended up in an AA meeting. Today I realized that what happened is he ran out of ideas of how to get me sober, and he finally picked me up and set me in an AA meeting. He says, now sit there and shut up. And nobody else told me that, but he did. And the third step says, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over the care of God. My God, me turn my will and my life over the care of God? I could just see me sending off a message to that effect and having one of the angels run up to God and say, oh, Paul just signed to turn his will and his life over. Oh, he did? Get him. I've been looking for him, you know, for a long time. And I don't want any draw any attention to me. And the same way with writing that fourth step. Write an inventory. All the stuff about yourself that you can't stand, that you didn't want ever want anybody to know, the worse it is, the more reason why you ought to write it down. And they want you to write this stuff down, whereas you have a nosy wife and kids who would just love to find that stuff. You know, and I thought, well, and then what I'll do is I'll keep it with me. I won't keep it in the house. I'll just write it small and I'll keep it with me so they can't find it. And that seemed good for about 30 seconds. And I thought, what if you get in an automobile accident and they take you to the emergency room? Yeah. I could see going to the hospital. I was on the staff of, and the nurse saying, oh, look what he got down here. He did do that, too, that I thought he did, you know. And reading that to all the nurses in the hospital. So I couldn't carry it with me. I couldn't leave any place. So I wrote it in code. You know, I wrote my inventory in code. I write shorthand. I can't read shorthand, but I can write shorthand. You know. I wrote it in code. I finally took it one day with I procrastinated as long as I could and took it with some other guy, and hell, he wasn't the least bit impressed, you know. And I was kind of disappointed, as a matter of fact. I thought it was juicier than that. And then I got on to the sixth and seventh step with the defects of character. And that was a strange thing. I said, really strange. It amazes me to this day. I was raised to know that you're supposed to get rid of your defects of character. You're supposed to not have them. You're supposed to realize them, and then don't do that anymore. You know, if getting angry is a defect of character, then you stop getting angry. And you root those defects out, and you use willpower and guts and stamina and backbone, and you work on yourself and build character and be a man, shape up. And I get to the program, and I says, no, you don't do that. No, you don't do that at all. You don't do that at all. You look at your defects and say, yeah, that's me. That's the way I am. Yep, that's who I am. Yeah. You may become willing to be different, but you don't root it out. You ask God, say, hey God, how about doing something about this anger that I got? How about this procrastination? How about this lying or stealing? How about this my drinking problem? How about you doing something about it? I'm willing to have you do it. And you ask him to do it. And you allow him to do it. And you don't get ticked off at yourself if he ain't done it yet. That's the odd part about it. That's it. Then you make your list of people you have to make amends to, and you go make them. You feel like a nut making them. You feel like a nut until you make them. It seems just awful. It just seems like the awfulest thing in the world to go and make amends to a jerk who really ought to be making amends to you. But yet, every time I made an amend to somebody for something they had done to me and I had played a part of, I felt more like a man. I felt more like a man. And I remember a particular occasion on the program. Another guy on the program did something. We had an altercation. And I went to him and made amends for it. And he accepted my amends. And then he was really distraught because I was the first one to come. He wished he had been the one to come first. And it's a secret that I've learned. If I'm going to make amends to somebody on the program for an argument we've had or something, I want to be the first one to say it so they'll feel rotten. You know? So in the rest, in the ninth and tenth, I don't really, as I said, I don't have any problems with staying physically sober today. My problems are more a question of being emotionally sober. I used to allow other people to control how I felt. I still do if I'm not observant and watching. But it used to be I didn't even know that I had a choice. I realize today that however I feel, at every moment of every day, however I feel, I'm exercising a choice. I'm deciding to feel that way. If somebody has me really upset, I have decided to be upset. I usually find out that that person isn't worth my upsetness. In fact, they're usually a jerk. And the more I try to control another person, the more I'm under that person's control, because if what I do or don't do next depends on whether they do or don't do whatever it was I was trying to get them to do or not do, then I'm under their control. And if you follow that, you're probably an alcoholic. My problems today aren't so much drinking problems. My specific problems today are drinking problems. It's been 20 years and 2 months since my last drink, since I accepted my alcoholism. And my life has changed so dramatically since I accepted the challenge of being an alcoholic. And I find that today, life consists of accepting the challenge that life has to offer. Accepting the challenges of reality of life. It's kind of a game I play with. I talked about being at odds with God. By doing these steps and working this program, I got back to the God of my childhood and then progressed on beyond that. And today I have a real close relationship with a God of my higher power of my own choosing. And he's not the God of my childhood. He isn't one who specializes in guilt. He doesn't want me to feel guilty all the time. He doesn't want me to hate myself for the rotten person I've been. He and I are good friends. We're good friends. We talk often every day and frequently throughout the day. And he cares about me and I care about him. Lots of times I tell him, be sure and have a good day. You see, you have yourself a good day today. Go off and enjoy yourself. Don't worry about me and just keep me out of any trouble. If you have a good day, I'll probably have a good day. And in fact, I tell him, see, what I did with my life was I put him in charge. And then I made up a partnership agreement between me and my higher power. I went to the store, the This is a supply store. And I bought the papers for a limited partnership. And I drew up a limited partnership between me and my higher power. And then he has a controlling interest in my life. He's a general partner and I'm the limited partner. And then after you draw up the partnership agreement, then you have to draw up the terms of the partnership. And in the terms of the partnership, you put down who's going to handle what. You see that? So that each one of the partners knows what they're responsible for. And I know that he knew what he was responsible for, but I needed to know that he knew that what he was responsible for. And I like to have it there. It's in writing, buddy, you know. So I put it down, what he was in charge of. And essentially what it narrows down to, I'm in charge of all the work, and he's in charge of all the worry. He never helps me with the work. He doesn't come down and do any of it. But, and the same token, he doesn't like me to help him with the worry. He'd much rather do it all by himself. Just leave it alone. And so it's kind of like I tell him that, I'll pedal and you steer. And for God's sake, watch where you're going. Because I'm sick of some of the places we've been. So he's in charge. I'm in charge of doing things and he's in charge of outcome. And that's the way life is for me. I do all the work and he does the worry. I can do anything I want and he's going to take care of the outcome of whatever it is. And since doing that, you know, I haven't made a single mistake since I did that. In all aspects of my life, I haven't made a single mistake since I formed that limited partnership agreement with him in charge. I mean, he's done some really stupid things, but I haven't made any mistakes. My problems today are all thinking problems. They're not drinking problems, but thinking problems. And in fact, anytime I think I have a problem, I have a problem. And if I don't think I have a problem, I don't have a problem. I've never yet ever thought I had a problem and been wrong. And I decide the sizes of my problems. I can, whatever I think about, I put power into it. My mind is like a like a searchlight. It focuses on things, and whatever it focuses on, an energy goes from my mind right to the object, and it puts energy into it. And I have a choice as to what I focus it on. And if I focus it on what's good, it gets gooder, and if I focus it on what's bad, it gets badder. And I have those choices today. In fact, I can take any little problem and just build it up just by thinking about it. I can take a non-problem. I can look at something like that. Well, you can see that's no problem. But you know, if you think about it a minute, it could be. Pretty soon I'm thinking, by gosh, this is kind of a problem. Pretty soon I'm thinking, by gosh, it's a good thing I'm looking at this. Everybody else is missing it. Pretty soon I'm overwhelmed with this some problem. And I can't get rid of it. I can do that with my. My wife, just thinking how difficult it is living with her, get to be a big, big problem. She and I have been married for end of this year, it'll be 48 years, and we've been emotionally involved with each other for over 60. Oh wow, he's right, In fact, like I often say, these young kids today—they don't have what it takes to put together a relationship like that. No, they don't. The young kids today don't have what it takes to put together a relationship like that. For one thing, you've got to be very, very old. But they hang in there, I suppose. It's kind of like Angie. Angie S. says, there's only two rules for becoming an old-timer in AA. There's two rules. Just don't drink and don't die. And anybody can make it. One of the things that has helped me a great deal, especially in this thinking thing, is that I shouldn't really say my name is Paul and I'm an alcoholic. I should say my name is Paul and we are alcoholics. Because I'm not alone up here. You know? I got more people live in my head, more personalities. Just there are more people. One of them that, and each one has their own idea of how to handle any situation. And one of them says, no matter what it is, he says, well, I don't know about you, but I'm going to have a drink. And we'd all march off and you have a drink, you know. And, one of them says, well, is always afraid, no matter what it is. He says, oh my God, don't do that. You'll screw it up and they'll all laugh at you. Don't do that. And what it is, it always says that. Don't do that. Don't lead a meeting. Don't sponsor anybody. Don't read. Don't pitch. Don't get up to the podium. You know, don't do any of those things. Yet there's one up there in my head that says, man, with this program, you can go anywhere and face anybody under any circumstances, and nobody can harm you. Nobody can harm you, because nobody can really harm you except to make you take a drink or a drug. And with this program, nobody in no situation can make us take a drink or a drug. That's tremendous power. We can do anything. And the funny part of it is that those voices, they're always talking. And that's the way my head, I don't know how your head is, but that's the way my head is. That's the way I think. There's somebody talking all the time. Talk, talk, talk. Day and night. Talk. Never shut up. Talk. All the time. Talk. You come to me and drink too much coffee and you get real hyped up. They go talk. A lot of times, my body wants to lie down and go to sleep. My brain says, no, let's lay here and talk about it a while. Talk. You know, middle of the night, I'm sound asleep. And they say, hey, wake up. We need to tell you something. You know, talk. You know that thing that you thought went so well today and you were so pleased with? It wasn't like that at all. You know, they're really ticked off at you. And we want to tell you about that. Talk. And you did the same thing a few months ago. Talk. In fact, you've done it a lot. In fact, you do a lot of stupid things. You don't want to write, you don't want to do your fourth step. By God, we'll lay here and take it for you tonight. Talk. I used to drink and use drugs to shut the people up. Shut up, so I can get some sleep. You know, that was the only way I could ever get to sleep. I didn't have a drinking problem. I had a sleeping problem. I had to shut them up, for God's sake. Today I don't use drugs. I don't shut them up. They're suggestions. They're not orders. That's not God saying, do that. And they're suggestions. And they say these things, like they'll say, well, screw her. And I think, no, that's just a suggestion. We won't, tell them to screw off, you know. That's just a suggestion. Thank you for participating. Now, if you'll sit down, we'll call on somebody else. You know? It's like AA. I don't follow every suggestion that everybody makes. I say, well, thank you. And I've been, yes, I think, yeah, listen. And I don't know how it is with you, but that's how God talks to me. He talks to me as one of the voices in my head. And the voices in AA. And I listen to all of them. And then I have to pick, when's it God's voice? And when isn't there? Is it the newcomer? Is it the old timer? Is it somebody in between? Or when is it? Or is it all time? And which ones do I follow? Which voices, which suggestions do I follow? I can't possibly follow them all. And that determines my life. The voices that I listen to and the ones I decide to. But today I make the decision. That's the difference. As long as I'm clean and sober, I can make the decision as to which voices I want to follow. And so I listen to the voices, and they're all friends of mine now. They may have some really stupid ideas, suggestions, but they're still, their intentions are good. Their intentions are to help me. And as I say, my relationship with Max keeps getting better and better. I'm standing here talking to you, communicating, and that's such a major part of AA, is somebody stands at the podium and talks, and the rest listen, and then they take turns, and we talk back, one drunk talking to another. Communication is such a major part of AA program and of our sobriety and our serenity and our way of life. I want to very quickly to review the history that, as I understand it, as I picked it up as I went along, because it seems very important to me. And quickly, when I was in the nut ward of the hospital, up at St. Joseph's Hospital in Orange, they called it the rush center. And they didn't call it a rush center because people are just rushing to get in. They call it the rush center after Dr. Benjamin Rush. Now, Dr. Benjamin Rush was one of three physicians who signed the Declaration of Independence. So you know when he lived, back in the days of the Revolution. He did a bunch of important stuff, but 2 points I want to make here tonight. One was he wrote a letter to General Washington telling him that some of his revolutionary soldiers that were getting drunk were sick and needed help. Of more importance than that, Benjamin Rush wrote a treatise on alcoholism as a disease. Now that goes back to the days of the Revolution, from the when we separated from England. He wrote a treatise on alcoholism as a disease. And the fact that, as I understand it, he listed 12 stages of the disease and 12 stages of recovery, which I guess would be like the original 12 and 12. The point is that Dr. Bill Silkworth, a neurologist, was the physician for Bill W. the last time he was hospitalized. And he also believed in this idea that alcoholism was a disease. And he apparently convinced Bill W. that alcoholism was a disease, not a moral issue, not an issue of intellect or bad habit or stupidity or a neurosis. It's a disease, a medical problem. Alcoholism, chemical dependency, is a medical problem. I think my guess is we might very well not be sitting here tonight talking about this if that hadn't happened, if Bill hadn't been convinced that this was a medical problem. It was Ebbie that came, that convinced him that the only answer was a spiritual one. It was a medical problem with a spiritual answer. He, Ebbie, and also Bill W. were both members of the Oxford movement. And the Oxford movement, a very prominent part of it was to proselytize, to go around and tell other people about it and get them to join. So they had three elements. One was medical problem, spiritual answer, have to give it away to keep it. He got the idea himself of maybe once he got sober on the spiritual experience of his medical problem, he got the idea that maybe by telling other alcoholics about it, he could stay sober and they would stay sober too. And he went around talking to alcoholics trying to get them to stay sober by him telling them about his spiritual experience. I understand he talked to about 73 of them, none of whom stayed sober. And he was disappointed because his idea wasn't working. And he was complaining to his wife, Lois, and says, "My idea didn't work." Doesn't work, telling one drunk talking to another. My idea doesn't work. And she says something to the effect, "Well, it does work, stupid. You're sober." And he said, "Oh." And never been sober like long before, but he was sober. And the thing I thought was really interesting was he talked to Dr. Bill Silkworth about the fact that his idea of carrying the message to other alcoholics wasn't working. And Silkworth said, don't talk just about the spiritual part. Tell him about the medical problem first, and then the spiritual answer, and try that and see if that doesn't work. He says, "Okay, I'll try it." Went off to Akron. First drunk he tried it on, it worked. And when it worked, AA was born. And that first drunk turned out to be a doctor. And God, in his infinite weirdness, saw to it that that doctor was a proctologist, a specialist in rectal pain. Might be we wouldn't be sitting there tonight if that hadn't been the case. And that idea of communicating is the basis of this whole thing. We talk, and you're doing it tonight. You're sitting here listening. You're listening attentively. We make fun of people that are get up and wander around, stuff like that. But in general, people, have you ever, you stop and think of the number of alcoholics in this room in all stages of recovery or lack of recovery, all stages of anxiety and panic and tension and depression and hatred and everything else, yet we sit here and listen. That's a very loving thing to do. To listen to somebody else talking is a very loving thing to do. The opposite would be if you thought, oh my God, I can't stand any more of this crap and get up and walk out. You know, the person who's talking might get drunk. And we don't want them to get drunk. And we sit and listen, no matter what the person's saying, no matter how often we've heard it, no matter whether we agree with it or not, we sit there, yeah. You know, it's a very loving thing to do. And when we take it out of here and we go home and listen, it's very loving. It's very loving to listen to another person. It's very loving to try to communicate with another person. It's an act of love. An act of love. It's a loving thing to do. I think this whole program is based on that kind of love. Nobody knows what alcoholism is. They say it's a medical problem, but nobody knows what it is. Nobody but me, I know. I know, but I don't tell people because I don't want people to argue with me. I don't want them to debate it. I don't care whether they know or not, just so I know. And so I don't tell people. But I'll tell you, if you promise not to tell anybody. I think that alcoholics, chemically dependent people, have a tremendous capacity to generate love and an inability to express it. And because they can't express it, it builds up as a pressure. A pressure that builds and builds and builds. They put drugs in and alcohol in to suppress that feeling. And that seems to help momentarily, but it actually makes it worse. If not anything else, it aggravates the communications defect. And the people, and they not only can't express love, they can't accept love. So the people that live with the alcoholic, the people that love the alcoholic, can't express their love to the alcoholic, and the pressure builds up for them. And they begin to go crazy. And the pressure builds up, and the pressure comes out not as love, but as anger, frustration, resentment, irritation, abuse, all kinds of abuse. And what happens? You know, there's no answer to that. Doctors can't help that with that. They just give pills of the same kind to suppress the feelings. And that doesn't do anything. It doesn't help the communication problem. But what happens? They come to AA, and we treat them like newcomers. I've always been very impressed with how we in AA treat newcomers. We treat them, we just love them. No matter who they are, where they've come from, what they've done, what they haven't done, don't we have a damn any of that stuff. We're just glad you're here. And then we love them. In fact, and then what happens is that pretty soon they're sitting quietly and listening and letting somebody talk, and that's an act of love. The next thing you know, they smile at somebody, or they shake hands with somebody, or they get somebody a cup of coffee, or they start doing loving things. And they're getting better and better, and they don't even know what they're doing. And later on, they find out they're sober, and they don't even know why. And what's happened is we've been loving the hell out of them. You know, people come here with hellish lives, and we just love the hell right out of their life. And they learn, that's why they say this is a program of action. And you begin to do these loving things and get weller and weller and weller. And as long as we keep doing them, we stay well. And we quit doing them, we end up back where we were. The pressure builds up and we end up drunk. I was down in San Diego last weekend at a convention, and a woman was there from Washington, D.C., and she talked about a man who had gone back out to drinking after 42 years of sobriety in AA. This disease does not go away. I have a disease and it's following me. It's following me. And it will follow me until I die. And I have no way of knowing how far behind me it is. Yes, I have one way to find out how far behind me it is. I can stop going to meetings. And when it catches me, I say, oh, that's how far back it was. You know? But as long as I keep giving this thing away, giving it away and being loving. I really enjoy. I'm glad to know that he's there, he or she or whatever. I'm glad it's there because it keeps me moving. Keeps me. I say this one thing. I love doing this. There's a line in our book. It says on page 132. Check it out. In the middle of the page, very middle of the page, 132. It says we absolutely insist on enjoying life. We absolutely insist. And if you're not enjoying this program, you haven't done enough of it yet, or you're not doing it right. And if you're not enjoying life, you're not doing it right. In my opinion, My phone number, incidentally, I live in the 714 area. My phone number is 240-3940, 240-3940. So if you want to argue if you want to argue, screw you. But if you want to, if you want to know any more about any of this stuff, I'd be glad. I give you anything I've got in the way of this program because it helps me to stay sober. And my higher power, he's a good guy. And if you don't have a higher power you like, use mine. Just mine. Just feel free to go ahead. You don't need to ask me. Just go use them. Tell them I sent you. And life just keeps getting better and better. It's like a gal. I didn't hear her say it, but I heard of a gal who said that she said it at the AA podium. She said she used to drink for the fun of it. She enjoyed drinking. She enjoyed it so much she drank for the fun of it. And she drank for the fun of it all the time until drinking got to be a habit. And she drank out of habit until drinking got so bad that she had to drink. And then it got so bad that she had to go to AA, and she went because she had to until it got to be a habit. Now she goes to AA for the fun of it. That's the way to do it. Thank you very much.
I surely appreciate Dr. Paul being here.
This is recorded October the 11th, 1987, at the MWA Club.
This is a Caskey recording.
For copies of this and other tapes, write P.O. Box 50019, Long Beach, California, 90815.